most accurate to 10 decimal places with George Mendo, Andy Burke, and Joseph's The Jodcast, June Extra Edition. Hello and welcome to the Jodcast. I'm George, and joining me today in the studio are Fiona and Indy. Hello.
Hiya.
Hi, George.
In the show this time, Indy talks to Dr. Daniel Mortlock about finding quasars with astrostatistics, and Joe Zuntz answers your astronomical questions. But first, before all that, Indy talks to Matthias Vidal in this month's JodBite.
For this month's JodBite, I'm talking to Dr. Matthias Vidal. Hi, Matthias.
Hi.
To get things started off, could you maybe just tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to be working at JVCA?
I'm from Chile. I came here to do my PhD with Dr. Clive Dickinson. And now I just finished last December my PhD, and now I'm a postdoc here.
Cool, great. So what did you work on during your PhD?
It's a mix between cosmology and interstellar medium. It's very related to the CMB science. It's called CMB foregrounds. And it's a study of the emission that is in the radio frequencies that we observe the CMB, that is not the CMB, and it's mostly coming from our own galaxy. So my PhD was trying to understand and characterize particular synchrotron emission from our own galaxy in polarization, and also a relatively new type of emission that was discovered a few years ago that is called anomalous microwave emission. So I'm focusing those two things.
Are you continuing that work in your postdoc?
But now I'm also part of the Planck collaboration. So
okay.
Using sort of similar analysis that I used for my PhD, but now with Planck data.
Okay, cool. So what instruments, what telescopes were you using during your PhD? Were you using ground-based telescopes or space or a bit of both?
Yeah, a bit of both. I started as a member of the QUIET collaboration, which was a CMB polarization experiment that was located in Chile in the Atacama Desert, the same place where ALMA is.
All right.
Then that was one part of my PhD. Also worked with WMAP data, satellite that was observing the CMB, and also data from an interferometer in the US called KARMA.
Okay.
And that was used for anomalous microwave emission studies in some particular clouds in our galaxy. Yeah, it's a bit of mostly radio astronomy, but yeah, a bit of everything.
And so when you say you're looking at these other sources of CMB emission or of radio emission, what exactly is the goal? Are you trying to make a picture of these foregrounds, or is the goal then, I mean, what are you trying to do?
Yeah, I mean, for CMB people, for cosmologists, the foregrounds are just contamination that they want to remove. The data set that WMAP and Planck and the CMB experiments provide are most of the emission is coming from this galactic emission. Most of the, there is actually a small percentage that is CMB. Mm-hmm. So there is a lot of information about our own galaxy that we can learn from this using these data sets. I'm using polarization data, WMAP and now Planck, to study the magnetic field in our galaxy. And there are some structures in the galaxy, like sort of filamentary structures, that are very big, one of the largest structures in the entire sky, which are visible in polarization at these frequencies. It's not really clear what these things are, and it's because now we have this data set that can really measure observational properties and try to compare with models of the galaxy of magnetic field and particles. Cosmic particles like traveling in these field lines, which emit the radiation that we see.
So tell me a bit more about the magnetic field of our galaxy. I mean, is this something? Do all galaxies have a magnetic field, or how is it structured?
On a fundamental level, is not very clear how this magnetic field started from like the formation of the galaxy. But it is observed that most galaxies, like spiral galaxies around us on Milky Way, have a northern component of a magnetic field, which is most of the time parallel to the galactic plane. And also it has a turbulent component, which is because of the nature of the interstellar medium that is sort of fractal and turbulent. You have these two components. In that synchrotron emission, and in particular polarization, is very useful to study this because the polarization is sort of comes from regions where you only have a northern magnetic field. because the component that is turbulent will vanish after, like, the emission from a turbulent region will not be polarized. By using polarization, we can study the other component, which is like the large scale component of the magnetic field of the galaxy.
It sort of gives rise to this polarized emission, but does it affect the other components of the galaxy? Does it affect galaxy evolution or formation? Do we know anything about this, or
the magnetic field itself?
Yeah.
I'm sure it does, but the question is to which extent? I don't know. I'm not an expert in galaxy evolution, but I think that's one of the interrogants that have been there, because there must be at least important in star formation, or because the galactic fields in star forming region, and when you have massive stars, can be very big. So that must have an important contribution also in the galaxy. So it can get to really high values sometimes. So you have, like, what I'm studying in particular is the diffuse component, mm-hmm. which is relatively smooth and not very, very highly magnetized. But as soon as you go to, like, smaller regions in space, even in molecular clouds, you expect the magnetic field to be higher, just because the regions are more dense and mm-hmm. and the environmental field get compressed as well.
Okay, so the fields on really large scales are just kind of not that strong and kind of smooth, but exactly, then when you zoom into sort of denser areas, there's more fields.
But then it becomes turbulent, so it's like uh-huh. you can have a region where it's very, very high, but
it's difficult to study.
Yeah.
I think cosmic magnetism is one of the, or the magnetism of the Milky Way, at least, is one of the science goals of the SKA as well. They're really interested in looking at that sort of stuff.
I think that will give us a lot of information, because the good thing about the SKA is that it's observing low frequencies and in a very, very broad spectrum. So you can use a technique that is called far rotation to observe the magnetic field along the line of sight, mm-hmm. not only the integrated component.
As far as your work goes, you're basically just sat in front of a computer most of the time and you're analyzing data. Do you get to go out to the telescopes that you've used or things like that?
Yeah, I mean, now I've been sitting on the computer for a long time, but I used to, when I started my PhD, I went to Chile to observe with this, with a quiet experiment. That was very cool. I spent 3 weeks there. And the place is amazing. But since then, well, now I'm using mostly space observatories.
That's a bit difficult to go on. So.
Yeah. And other telescopes that now I have data. You normally you have an astronomer that observes the data for you. So it's not a bit like ALMA, that now most of the time you just, uh-huh. they will send you the data. It's a bit sad, because going to observe is always, I guess that anyone that wanted to study astronomy, like, start with the romantic idea of being, like, in the telescope at some moment.
Sure.
I think that with time that is going to become less and less frequent.
I think the telescopes are getting quite isolated as well, so it's difficult to, there on a database. I mean, you went to the Atacama Desert. What was it like observing up there? I mean, I guess you must feel far away from everything else, really.
Right? Yeah, I mean, it's quite extreme. I mean, the quiet experiment was as an experiment, and that means that it's not an observatory that is properly installed there, you know? It's like it only was observing for a few years, and then it stopped. So it's right. not, so the, in terms of facilities and electricity, internet connection, everything is not optimal. One of the reasons we have to go, like, every day to the telescope itself is to bring the data back. So we burn the data sure. in disks. Uh-huh. And you have to also, the electricity was provided by generators there.
Wow.
So. Yeah. Be aware that the petrol truck comes, and so it's a bit more engineering with the telescope, but it's sure. quite fun. I mean, it's like a good adventure. Now, I guess if you work in a proper observatory like ALMA or Optical SBLT, it's nothing like that.
Well, we had an interview with Liz Guzman, who was from ALMA actually, and she was describing how there's a huge infrastructure set in place basically for all of those things. So they're not as isolated as it may seem.
Yeah, no, that's true. I mean, when I went to observe Kauai, we were using the road that ALMA built to get to the site, just because it's more secure than the other one.
Sure.
And then you consider the size of that. And, I mean, these guys built that road. They had, like, fiber optical links.
Coming back to your current work, so you're sort of working in the Planck data, and, I mean, without getting you to spill your secrets, how does that, what's the way forward for foreground studies? I mean, is the goal to have a sort of complete picture of what's going on, and then that's it, you can move on to something else, or?
Yeah, in terms of CMB foregrounds, the answer is something like that the idea is to really quantify what is CMB and what is not CMB, And that is a difficult problem, just because there are many components that produce radiation at those frequencies.
Okay.
It's not a simple task to do. At least the residuals that you have from your subtraction method are smaller, or you understand them really well, then you can say, okay, this is foreground, that is CMB, and I check the CMB and I do my science. So, and that's fine. But for the galactic science, there is a lot of data there that has to be interpreted. The CMB, in a way, the signal is relatively simple. It's, mm-hmm. it's a Gaussian field and we understand it, but the foregrounds, like the galactic emission, is very complex and it has much more information than the CMB, so there is a lot of science that can be done.
Can come out of that.
It's a cool data set, and the great thing is that it's going to be available like very soon for the community. So
there should be a lot more insights on our galaxy from almost an unintended offshoot of the CMB project. Okay, cool. Well, thanks a lot, Matthias. Thanks for talking to us today, and good luck with your research.
Thanks.
Thanks for that, Indy. Now Indy talks to Dr. Daniel Mortlock about astrostatistics.
I'm with Dr. Daniel Mortlock from Imperial College London. Hi, Daniel.
Hi, Indy. How are you?
Good, thanks. Thanks for being on our show. So to start things off, could you just give us in a few words what your research is about?
I'm what's called an astrostatistician, which is a word that didn't exist until a few years ago, which is someone who sort of straddles the world of astronomy and mathematics. And I do a lot of data analysis and trying to get the most out of the data that astronomers get from the big telescopes around the world.
Okay, that's really interesting. So were you initially trained more as a mathematician or as an astronomer?
No, I was trained, I did a physics degree as an undergrad because I, in about second year, ran into a wall when it came to some of the more complex mathematical topics, and so had to curtail that. And it's kind of a bit weird now that my position at Imperial is half in the mathematics department and half in the physics department, and I teach a lot of statistics, having never done a statistics course, So my training was all physics, and the statistics was learned on the job, as it were, actually trying to do research and solve practical problems.
So I'm guessing with the advent of new modern telescopes, which produce absolutely huge amounts of data, that's where the statistics really comes in useful.
That's right. So one of the key changes is that, you know, 100 years ago, the idea was that you'd have an astronomer, you know, maybe even looking through the eyepiece of a telescope, looking at the object they were interested in, you know, drawing pictures of it or eventually taking photographs of it. And, you know, over the last few decades, there's been this change that now these telescopes take huge surveys of the sky where they're not looking at any one particular object. They're trying to get a representative picture of some aspect of the universe. And that means that what the astronomer gets at the end, the researcher gets, is a huge database of all these objects with their positions and how bright they are and other properties. And this starts to become more like a data mining problem and less like a traditional astronomy problem. So that's why there's this, you know, huge motivation for applying statistical techniques to try and, in my case in particular, find the rarest objects, the unusual things in these huge data sets.
I'm just going to ask you for a sort of example of what you can do with statistics in astronomy and why it's useful to use these techniques.
So one thing that I'll be talking about today in my seminar in a couple of hours at Manchester is hunting through a big survey done at infrared wavelengths, so just, you know, longer wavelengths, redder than the human eye can see, the sort of thing that you've seen in movies through night vision goggles. And what we're doing with this survey called UKIDS is, amongst other things, looking for the most distant quasars that we can see, objects that you see a very red color largely because of the expansion of the universe stretching out the light. These objects are very rare. In maybe a catalogue of 100 million objects, there might be 10 of the target things that we're looking for. So they're very rare. It's real sort of needle in a haystack stuff. And it turns out that if you just look through the data and try and find things that have sort of the appearance of what you're looking for, you might find your 10 objects, but you're dominated by thousands and thousands of things that look red but aren't really, because of the fact that the data is imperfect. So then it's a case of applying statistics to try and separate out the things that, you know, look like what you're looking for by coincidence versus the things that really are like that. And so that's one of the projects that we've been working on.
Your role as an astronomer, do you usually work on data sets that have already been collected and that, you know, already out there in public, or do you collaborate closely with observers and set up observations where you know that your statistical expertise is going to come in handy?
More the former. More it's the sort of thing where these big surveys are happening, you know, the momentum behind them is already there and you know that this huge data set is going to come. certainly I try and get involved in the data quite closely, because to really understand what's going on, you've actually got to get involved. It's much harder to just sit there and download a huge file from some server and then get going on it, because, you know, it's very complex. It's not that simple. But in spirit, yeah, the main thing is that this data is already available, and it's a case of sifting through, because the night sky is a very rich place. And even though maybe tens or hundreds of astronomers have looked at the data and done the science they want to do with it, there's usually more things that can be done just because of the nature of the universe we live in.
So you can get maybe new information or interesting insights out of data that's previously been published, and people think, oh, well, we've done all we can with that, and you can sort of come up.
Absolutely. I mean, an example of this, it's not research that I've done, but one of the things that I've seen done a few times now is where people go back and look at almost the oldest astronomy data we have, where people were using glass plates to take images from telescopes maybe 100 years ago.
Wow.
And obviously they couldn't see the faint things that you see with the Hubble or anything like that. But so you're only looking at the brightest stars. But it turns out that this is really important, because the brightest stars are sufficiently close to Earth that they actually move across the sky very slowly. And that means that you can try and measure that motion using modern telescopes, but the trouble is that in the couple of years that you might be doing a survey, they haven't gone very far. Whereas if you can find these objects on these old plates, because of the baseline, the fact you've got a century of motion in there, even though the data aren't so good, it's actually the best way to measure how they're moving. Mm. So people have been systematically going through and doing this, and, you know, as a result have discovered some exciting things.
Do you have a favorite wavelength, or do you work more in the optical or the infrared or radio or any of the above, as long as there's enough data?
Yeah, it's really any of the above as long as there's enough data. It's one of the fun things about being at least in part a statistician, is that you can sort of scan around and look for interesting problems, not just in any areas of astronomy, but more broadly as well. And so in astronomy, the fact that, you know, I was using this infrared data to look for these distant quasars was a case of, I suppose, form follows function. It's, you know, this was the wavelength where we'd see these objects distinguished from other astronomical sources, and so that's why I worked with that data. The actual wavelength at which the data comes in is almost an irrelevance in terms of the analysis, or it can often be.
And what are some new problems or areas that are facing astronomy and astrophysics that could possibly be solved using a statistical approach more than the standard astronomy techniques?
So, there's a couple of things like this, and an example that I think is really exciting is a new telescope that's not yet been built, but will be by the US, called the Large Synoptic Survey Telescope, or LSST, as it's generically known, just the acronym. It will be one of the larger telescopes in the world, with an 8-meter mirror, but unlike the other big telescopes like that, which are used for making very detailed observations of particular objects, this one will be equipped with the optics such that it can do big surveys of the sky for looking at much fainter sources than the current survey telescopes do. And then not just that, it won't just make surveys of the sky that are very deep, it'll also do this repeatedly, so that you get a sort of dynamical picture of the sky and you see variable stars and supernovae and moving objects and things like this. And so in terms of the data it'll produce, it'll reveal all sorts of things that we haven't seen before, but only if we can actually process this data sensibly, because the volumes will be sort of orders of magnitude, factors of 100 or 1,000 bigger than any current surveys. And it's pretty clear that the current techniques for analyzing this data won't work, that we'll need to supplement this with techniques from machine learning and computer science and statistics as well. So so this project, I think, is an example of the sort of thing where astronomy is really becoming a data science, and it's not my favorite buzz phrase, but it's definitely a case of big data.
Actually, speaking of computers, in your day-to-day work, do you need to use, you know, supercomputers or very powerful computers to process all the data, or is it still relatively simple to the extent that you can process it on something that's accessible to the average person?
So in terms of taking the data from the surveys that I've been working with, like UKIDS and the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, the SDSS, another survey I use, the people who run these surveys and take the data and produce the catalogs, they do that using large computers, and that's a very sort of serious endeavor. But in terms of what I myself do, in terms of trying to find the objects we're looking for and so forth, I think it's true that I've done almost all, or maybe even all of that, on my 4-year-old MacBook Pro. For me, at least, I'm not one of these people who gets into sort of big algorithms and speeding up computer programs and so forth, partly because I'm not very good at it. Whereas what does interest me is sort of new ways of looking at the data. And actually, a lot of the time you can, you know, find some techniques which don't require huge computational effort. So I imagine, you know, lots of people listening to this have got a Mac laptop or, you know, something similar. You know, it's nothing special in terms of computing.
Okay, that's really interesting. And going back to the search for the quasars, how many in the end did you find? How many needles in the proverbial haystack showed up?
So in the end, we found 14 needles in that haystack, and 6 or 7 of those were these distant quasars that had already been seen before in other surveys, which was a good test because we wanted to make sure that we were finding the things that we knew were already in that area. But the really exciting thing was that we found what was and remains, at least, you know, currently of the date of this interview, the most distant one of these bright quasars ever found, which was something that we were incredibly excited about. And the reason for this is that, I suppose, comes back to the finite speed of light, that the more distant an object you see in the universe, the longer the light's been traveling from it, and you're seeing it as it was when the universe was that little bit younger. And so for this quasar, we see it as the universe was when it was about 800 million years old, which is only 5% of its current age of about 13.8 billion years. And, you know, it's only 100 million years younger than the previous record holder. But it turns out this is a very exciting time in the history of the universe. It's when all the hydrogen gas that was making galaxies and between galaxies was getting split into electrons and protons by the first generations of stars lighting up. And it turns out that these bright quasars are one of the best ways to see what's going on there. They act as a kind of lighthouse shining through everything between us and them. You know, this is the sort of astronomy payoff of doing all this statistics, of finding this, so far unique source. And there's probably only maybe 100 sources over the whole sky that are as bright and as distant as this.
Wow.
So that's, you know, that's the sort of the payoff of doing all this.
Oh, that's fantastic news. Well, there's a bright future ahead, excuse the pun, for astrophysics, I guess.
I think so, yeah.
Great. Well, thanks very much for talking to us, Daniel.
Absolute pleasure.
Thanks again, Indy. Now it's time for things we couldn't fit in anywhere else, the odds and ends. And I'll start off with an interesting thing that even appeared on the BBC News website involving the spacecraft Gaia. So Gaia was launched in December 2013 by the European Space Agency. It is the latest telescope designed to do ultra-precise measurements to stars within our galaxy. It is basically looking at parallax, which is kind of like the slight shift in the position of individual stars across the sky as the Earth moves around the Sun. As the Earth is moving in its orbit, it gets different perspectives on more distant stars, and you can use some clever trigonometry to find distances to these stars based on this shift. So the more precisely you can measure this, the larger distances you can measure within the Milky Way galaxy. And then beyond that, you can make more precise measurements of the actual brightnesses of stars, and even potentially measure how the stars are moving in three dimensions. To do this, you need a really sensitive telescope. Gaia has really sensitive detectors on it. It's kind of like a 3-meter wide cylinder, which is attached to a 10-meter wide sunshield to block out the light from the sun, which would blind the telescope otherwise. So that's a really big sunshield. What made the news is that despite this really huge sunshield, light is actually diffracting around the sunshield into the telescope optics. And so they're actually getting glare from the sun, even though they're not pointing at the sun. This is kind of analogous to if you could imagine if you have a harbor on the coast with a breakwater, and you could have a really long breakwater in front of your harbor, but if you have really strong ocean waves coming towards the harbor, they will actually diffract around the opening in the breakwater, and you will actually still get waves on the other side. This is analogous to what's happening with light with the Gaia satellite. It's actually very surprising, and currently the astronomers in the Gaia project team are working on how to deal with this scattered light phenomena. They think in the worst case scenario, it'll probably reduce the sensitivity of the telescope a little bit, but it's something that they can still compensate for.
So I guess that's just the nature of these sorts of projects, is that however well you prepare for everything, you're always going to run into some sort of unforeseen difficulty. But it seems that they're finding a way around it. So I guess, you know, no, it was going to go forward. You know.
Yeah, this was based on my experience with space observatories. This has always been something that's been encountered. Spitzer had issues with its detectors. Herschel actually lost an instrument for a few months, and they were afraid to turn it back on until they understood exactly what went wrong. Then, of course, there's always the very famous episode from 20 years ago where the Hubble Space Telescope was launched and the optics were slightly out of focus. Yeah. And at least with the Hubble Space Telescope, they were able to send a mission out on the space shuttle to put in corrective optics on the telescope. A lot of these other missions, they are beyond the reach of manned spaceflight. You just have to do the best with what you have.
I wonder, hypothetically, what could be done to solve this problem for Gaia. I mean, in terms of the structure of the sun shield that they're using. Like, you compared it to a breakwater. Do you think that the problem would be diminished by simply making the sun shield bigger? Or do you think there might be some kind of interesting shapes that they could make it that would make it not as big of a problem?
You would actually imagine that a 10-meter sun shield would be sufficient for a 3-meter...
You would think that, but it seems to be not the case, so maybe size isn't the issue here.
One of the current discussions is that there may have been some water ice or other ices that froze somewhere, I guess, on the edges of the sun shield after outgassing. They had ices that could form on other parts of the scientific payload, which is shielded by the sun shield, and they have little heaters for the probe, which can sort of evaporate off these ices, but the sun shield doesn't have this. So it's possible that it's this ice.
So it could be an issue of, like, maybe reflection rather than diffraction. Well, no, the ice is reflecting the...
They actually think it's a diffraction effect. It's definitely a scattered light effect. There may be ways that they can point the telescope where they don't encounter as much scattered light.
Moving on to something that is actually more down to earth. The construction for the largest optical infrared telescope kicked off recently by essentially blowing a huge chunk out of a mountain in the Atacama Desert. The mountain's called Cerro Armazones, and it's in the Atacama Desert in Chile. And people from ESO, the European Southern Observatory, detonated a whole bunch of explosives to essentially flatten the top of the mountaintop, which is where they're going to put the European Extremely Large Telescope, or the EELT. Is going to be essentially the biggest optical/infrared telescope in the world once it's completed sometime next decade. It's going to have a primary mirror of 39.3 meters in diameter and a secondary mirror of 4.2 meters. And so these mirrors are segmented. You actually can't make a flawless mirror that's 40 meters in diameter. So they're going to be segmented, and they're also going to have adaptive optics, which means that they sort of adapt to the atmospheric conditions so that you can get the best seeing possible. It's some of its goals. It's going to be a huge tool in exoplanet research, because they're going to use it to study Earth-like exoplanets, and especially possibly atmospheres of Earth-like exoplanets, so that we could possibly find some form of life or a detection of organic molecules in these atmospheres. And it's also going to be looking at some of the most distant galaxies that have ever been seen in the optical, and also the black hole in the center of our galaxy as well.
Are they detecting the exoplanets by directly imaging them, or are they going to be looking for radial motions of the planets, or is it going to operate in a way similar to Kepler, where it's they look at eclipsing, or are they going to do all three of those strategies?
I'm not entirely sure. I think the main technique is going to be similar to Kepler, where they're going to look for variations in the light curves of stars, which are candidates for having exoplanets. And I'm assuming that's how they're going to do it, because then they would be able to detect sort of light coming around the planet, which would presumably pass through the atmosphere as well, and that's how you'd possibly have a spectral study of the exoplanet itself.
Well, I'm just recalling the last time the three of us sat down to do a Jodcast together, George and Indy and myself, and we were talking about llamas in Chile. My question is, what about the llamas on this mountain here that they've blasted the side off of? It seems like this drastic move is going to have a huge environmental impact.
Yes, indeed. We must never forget the llamas. But I have to say that ESO has been working very closely with the Chilean government. And, I mean, having been out there to the Atacama as well, it is quite well protected. And they have a lot of things in place to sort of protect this unique wildlife and ecosystem. And I'm sure that, yes, they're blowing the top off a mountain, but I think they would have made sure that nothing would be too affected by this and that they would have cleared out all of the flora and fauna. Bearing in mind that this is a desert, so there aren't actually too many things on the tops of mountains and deserts.
That's true. So no llamas were harmed in the making of this telescope, then?
I think it's safe to say that, yeah.
Just one thing along those lines. So with Mauna Kea in Hawaii,
yeah.
It is like another like very dry and high altitude environment, but it's also like the one of only two dry high altitude environments in Hawaii, and so you actually get like a specific type of insect, the wiku bug, which is only found on Mauna Kea, and it's like a bug which evolved to eat stuff that was blown upslope, like other little dead insects. So, like, stuff that's done on Mauna Kea actually has an impact on that bug. Wow. To go back to Chile, though, Chile has lots and lots of high-altitude mountains, so it's very unlikely that you're going to have a species which is going to be restricted to living on a single mountaintop.
Mm-hmm.
And so blowing up a single mountaintop there will probably have less of an environmental impact than it would someplace like Hawaii.
Okay, finally, my odd and end today is taken from a very interesting article that I read recently to the effect that we don't know the universal gravitational constant, capital G, as well as we might like to believe. I feel like often as scientists, certainly as an undergrad, you really cling to these constants, as, you know, things that are true,
I think
things
G,
that are known.
I was going to say, I think G is one of my more favorite physical constants.
Yes, I love G.
As much as we can have that and the sigma and the Stefan Boltzmann equation and maybe the...
That was pretty cool. I always like Planck's constant, to be honest.
Planck constant, maybe not so much. I don't know why.
Yeah, no, I've always had a soft spot for G as well, so I think this is why this article caught my eye. So we all know it to be like 6.67 by 10 to the minus 11.
Yes.
But those decimal places are hugely controversial, it seems. So most of our measurements of G come from this experiment that was devised by Cavendish in the 1700s, which involved a torsion balance and some lead weights, and measured the faint attraction that they had to each other, and that's how we typically measure G. But it turns out that using that method, we get kind of different values every time with certain error bars on them. But the error bars actually don't overlap with each other. So really, it seems like a fairly dodgy method for determining anything, really, because you just can't say that the results are consistent. So a group have come up with a new way of measuring it, which involves interactions between ultra-cold atoms. So what they've done is they've got some rubidium atoms. They've surrounded the rubidium atoms with a cylinder of tungsten. The rubidium atoms are attracted to the tungsten, but also feel the force of gravity. Basically, by moving the tungsten up, you can pull the rubidium atoms against gravity, or by moving the tungsten down, you can accelerate them further. And so what they've done is they've kind of gotten these rubidium atoms and sort of shaken them around a little bit and had them settle. And once they settle, because of quantum effects between them, they form this sort of interference pattern. Any external force that is affecting them will show up as a kind of defect in this interference pattern. And by comparing it to the interference pattern that you might observe in the absence of any gravitational effects, make an estimation as to what the value of G is. So they've managed to measure G this way with an uncertainty of 150 parts per million. Now, obviously, this experiment is hugely sensitive to outside forces, so most of their efforts go into just completely reducing that. But I guess they think they've probably measured it perhaps a greater degree of accuracy than Cavendish's experiment, so that's cool. It agrees with less than half of Cavendish's measurements. So Cavendish, the Cavendish experiment, you know, has measured a load of different values that aren't consistent with each other. And this method is consistent with under half of those. But the fact that it is still consistent with some of them, they take to be a good thing. But I just thought this was mainly interesting because it just shows us really that we have to be humble. because we really know absolutely nothing. Yeah. We just make very good guesses.
Well, the other thing too is, I encounter this in my own science all the time, is that some people say, okay, well, we think we know that already. We're going to go off and do something new. And it's sometimes people just don't think about checking your answers on the other things. And I think this is an excellent example of that.
So, absolutely. You know,
People thought we knew G, but we don't.
We don't really. No.
Although, to be fair, measuring G sounds like you have to be really clever, and it also sounds really hard.
Yeah. Very expensive.
Yeah. That's true. I wouldn't know where to pick up rubidium in my local supermarket myself.
Well, this crowd have published a paper in Nature this year called Precision Measurement of the Newtonian Gravitational Constant Using Cold Atoms, and you can also read the article on Ars Technica, which we'll link on the website.
And now, after odds and ends, here is Joe with more precise answers to your questions in Ask an Astronomer.
Our first question comes from Martin Fuller, who was inspired by Stargazing Live to construct a homemade magnetometer using a Raspberry Pi and a compass. Well done, Martin. He says he's getting a periodic variation in the field strength that he measures every 24 hours and asks, is this really variation in the Earth's field, or am I picking up interference from a heating timer?
There's a nice Manchester University connection to this question. The research that I've been able to find on a daily variation of the Earth's magnetic field was done by Arthur Schuster, who was one of the founders of physics here in Manchester. We have a building named after him in the physics department. So between 1889 and 1907, he studied this question of whether there is a daily variation of the Earth's magnetic field. And he found one. He found a magnetic field variation of 10 to the minus 4 Gauss over the course of a day, and he attributed that to ionization in the upper atmosphere caused by the sun. Unfortunately, Martin detects something a bit bigger than that, about 100 times bigger, 10 to the minus 2 Gauss. So I suspect that something else is causing what Martin's finding with his magnetometer. A few possibilities for this. There are various ones. One anecdotal one I've heard today is that if you have a cat with a magnetic collar to open little cat doors, then that's possibly a cause of this. But possibly more likely is ambient temperature, is my guess, that ambient temperature is changing the physics of the detector that you're using. That would just be my guess. But it looks like what you found is not a real physical effect, I'm afraid.
All right, thanks for that question, Martin, and good luck with your homemade magnetometer. Our next question is from Franco Rodriguez. He asks, considering the conservation of energy principle, what happens to the lost energy a photon experiences when it redshifts during its long path through the cosmos? Could this be a possible dark energy source?
This is a surprisingly subtle question to do with conservation of energy and relativity and general relativity in particular. But we can boil it down to something a bit more sort of everyday that we can understand more easily. So imagine that you, Indy, are on a train holding a tennis ball. As far as you're concerned, that tennis ball is not moving relative to you, so it's got no kinetic energy, it's got no energy. If I'm standing by the side of the train and watching it whiz past me, as far as I'm concerned, that tennis ball is moving very, very quickly and has quite a lot of kinetic energy. So we know straight away that energy is not a thing that's the same in any frame of reference. So we call them inertial frames in physics, a frame of reference where the normal laws of physics apply. So we know this is a different quantity between two different places, so it's not a thing we should expect to be the same. And the principle of that energy being different in different frames applies just as much to photons as it does to tennis balls, except as our correspondent correctly notes, in photons that energy is to do with frequencies and wavelengths rather than just the tennis ball's direct speed. So it turns out that the frame of reference those photons are emitted in is different from the frame of reference they are received in, and that's because as the universe expands, what is changing, or a person in one position in the universe and in a different position in the universe are in two different frames of reference. So it's not that the photons have actually lost or gained energy, it's just that the way we interpret them has changed. And I'm indebted to the website physics.stackexchange for that quite nice analogy with the train.
Great, thanks a lot. So finally we've got a nice question from Andrew Tyzak, who asks, could it be possible for somebody aboard the ISS to lean out of a window and throw, in inverted commas, a time capsule to Mars? And this references one of our odds and ends in which we talked about a group of students who wanted to actually send a time capsule to Mars.
This is a very nice question. It takes me back in time to undergraduate days and Whittle Dynamics and those questions, which is great fun. And also to the great fun game Kerbal Space Program, where you get to do this kind of thing for real. The answer is basically no, unfortunately. Gravity means that you can't do that. There's two things that we need to distinguish quite carefully, and it's between weightlessness and zero gravity, and those are different things. When we see astronauts on the ISS floating around, that's not because there's no gravity there. It's because they're falling, and orbiting is a kind of falling, at the same speed as the capsule they are in. So it's because they're in free fall is why it looks like they're weightless and they're floating around. So there's no gravity, so you haven't got away from the Earth's gravitational field. So to get something to Mars, you still need to add in energy. You need to add in quite a lot of energy, and we can work out how much energy that is. So there's two speeds we need to know. We need to know the speed that you'd have to throw the thing to get it to Mars, And we need to know the speed that the ISS is already moving, because remember, the ISS is already going pretty fast, so, you know, maybe that's a big fraction of what we need to throw it at. The first impulse of any physicist when you have any kind of problem is to conserve energy. So how can I conserve energy in this problem? And we can do that to work out the escape speed that we need for the time capsule we're going to throw to Mars. So we say, okay, if I can figure out how fast the ISS is going now, if I throw this thing and it's just fast enough to get it away from the Earth's gravitational field into what we call infinity, although actually it will just be, you know, far enough away that it's no longer relevant, then we can do that equation. We can equate those two things. You can do that by knowing, for example, the radius that the ISS orbits at, that kind of question. So that's how we do that speed. To get the speed the ISS is actually moving at, we do a different kind of thing. We equate two different things, and that's the forces on the International Space Station, and that's the centripetal force that we need in a keep it where it is, and the Earth's gravitational force attracting it. And it turns out that's a very, very similar calculation to the first one. So the difference between those two things is how fast the astronaut would have to throw the ball out of the International Space Station. That's 3 kilometres a second. So unfortunately, unless our astronaut has a very strong arm and can throw his time capsule or her time capsule at 3 kilometres a second, then it won't be very easy to do.
Great. Well, thanks a lot for answering our questions, Joe.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you for that, Joe. And now on to feedback. We haven't had that much feedback this month. It seems like a lot of people are watching the World Cup, but Fiona does have a little bit of feedback for us.
We have a tweet from interviewee Professor John Butterworth, who was interviewed on the previous Jodcast, who mentioned that he enjoyed doing the interview with us. So thanks, John, for that.
And as usual, thanks for all the retweets and follow Fridays. And if you want to get in touch, you can do so via the website at www.jodcast.net.
On Twitter at twitter.com/jodcast.
On Facebook at facebook.com/jodcast.
On YouTube at youtube.com/jodcast.
On Flickr at flickr.com/groups/jodcast.
And don't forget that you can send us posts. The address is on the website.
All that's left to say is thanks to Dr. Daniel Mortlock and Dr. Matthias Fidel for the interviews. The editors were George Bendo, Sally Cooper, and Indy LeClerc. The producer was Sally Cooper. Until next time,
Jod on!